Welcome to Aerium Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 10th of February 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that we have with us today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well today. We've had a bit of a wild and windy weekend, but apart from that, everything's fine.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. Hasn't been too bad here. I was rather worried that there might be sort of hurricane force winds and tiles flying off the roof and all of that. But it hasn't happened, or maybe it hasn't happened yet. Maybe it's going to hit later. What we have heard is that we do have more people over here now in the country with coronavirus, and although we're not really going to get into that today, up until now, people have been thinking that this just affected Chinamen, because we've had no confirmation that it actually affects other races. And last week they were talking about the people that had died from this. I think it was Brits that had actually died from it, and they showed a picture of one, and he was white. So this is rather concerning that we may now have this disease on our shores. It may affect white people, it may affect Chinese people, and the government really don't seem to have done anything about it. I mean, really, they should have cut trade with China straight away. If you think of all the goods that are coming over from there, I've got an inkling that this is going to be something that we're going to be covering over the next few weeks or over the next few months. Before we really get into these news stories, Max, have you got any views on the coronavirus?
Well, just that it appears that the government have announced that they're going to restrict travel between China and the UK, but in about a week's time. And this really just smacks of shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because I think we've already got something like 4 confirmed cases of the virus here in the UK. We've got 2 centres that have been set up with people that are being quarantined. But I would imagine that there are very large numbers of people who have already travelled between China and the UK and who have just passed through our airports with minimal scrutiny. And so I think that I anticipate that there are going to be a lot more cases of coronavirus here in the UK in the weeks to come, which is quite sad.
Yeah, it is something that could have been avoided. I should imagine we will soon see people with those face masks on in the British cities. But as I say, we'll be probably be covering this over the next few weeks. We've got not very many political stories to get into this week, but what really has been in the main news is Philip Schofield, the ex-children's TV presenter that then went on to be a TV AM presenter and daytime television. In fact, he's been a regular sort of everyday television presenter for about the last 20 years. And last week he announced that he was homosexual, which on its own you would think, well, quite a few of these celebrities announce they're homosexual in order to win brownie points. But the strange thing about this is that he's actually been married for 27 years. And he has 2 adult daughters. I've got a quote here from The Guardian. Philip Schofield, the co-presenter of ITV's This Morning, has announced he is gay. In a statement released on the programme's Twitter account, the presenter, who has been married to his wife for almost 27 years and has 2 adult daughters, paid tribute to his family. With the strength and support of my wife and my daughters, I have been coming to terms with the fact I am gay, he said. And of course, the press has just been full of gushing praise for him, how courageous he is, how brave he is, how stunning he is. And, you know, it's absolutely disgusting. I mean, what the guy is saying is that he's been having affairs for the last 27 years. If he had said, I've had a mistress on the side for 27 years, people would be saying how immoral, how dreadful this is. But apparently, because it's homosexual and he's been having homosexual affairs, this is seen as somehow a good thing that he's done. This is really taking things to another level. I mean, we've seen this praise for people basically for having anal sex with their own gender for quite some time now. But to admit that he's been cheating on his wife all this time and then say that it's about the strength and support of my wife and my daughters, it's his wife and his daughters that, you know, the general population are feeling sorry for. The comment sections are full of criticism for him for this, and none of the newspapers are actually reflecting that. They're all saying how wonderful this is. And there's a backstory to this as well, but I just want to get your views on this announcement that he's made first, Max.
The thing that struck me first of all was the fact that in the statement that Philip Schofield initially made, he implied that there was no other third party involved, i.e. that he wasn't in a gay relationship with anybody else, and that the implication was that he had just over a period of time come to believe that he is gay. And it struck me that that was quite an implausible situation, because unless you are unless you do stray and have a gay relationship with somebody else, how do you actually know that you're gay? You know, if you're married to somebody, and according to Philip Schofield's public statement, he loves his wife very much and loves his family, etc., and has been very happy. Why would he suddenly start worrying about and fretting about the fact that he was gay if there was no other, if there was no gay lover on the scene? And it just seemed to me to be illogical that he would do this. And then because his homosexuality at that point, even if he believed himself to be homosexual, would just be an academic detail of his existence, because presumably, having decided he was homosexual, he wouldn't be having a sexual relationship with his wife, but he also, by the same token, wouldn't be having a sexual relationship with anybody else. And it would seem to be an unnecessary thing for him to make the public announcement that he did and upset his family and upset his wife and cause lots of embarrassment, etc., unless he had the intention of either entering into, or if he had already at some point in the past had homosexual relationships. And if indeed he has had homosexual relationships, as you've stated, it is the equivalent of a man announcing that he's been cheating on his wife for the last so many years during their 27-year marriage. And had he been cheating in a heterosexual way, then of course nobody would be coming forward to say how proud they were of the fact that he's been cheating on his wife. And so this whole issue is surrounded with a certain amount of mystery, and we wait to hear what further revelations are made. I noticed that also that Amanda Holden has made a couple of cryptic comments. What's been reported that she has, I haven't actually seen them myself, but apparently she's made some cryptic comments to the words to the effect that there's always something interesting going on behind the scenes, or something like that, words to that effect. So it would be interesting to see whether any other people come forward with any statements, and whether there are any more revelations about this. But the thing that's really sort of most disturbing about this is the fact that this story has hogged the news for the entire last week. Mail Online has been running something like six stories every day for the last week, just regurgitating the fact that Philip Schofield's mother and his mother-in-law and Holly Willoughby have all been coming forward to gush about how brave he is, and it just all seems to be incredibly over the top.
Damage control. That's what it is. It's damage control. And just to address that point that you made there about him thinking that he's homosexual, but he might not have engaged in those acts. This is the way that the word is changing. I mean, you cannot really be a homosexual. You can only carry out homosexual acts. It's like the word sodomy. It's an act. And the person that carries out the act is a sodomite. If somebody just finds men attractive, it doesn't mean they're homosexual. They're only homosexual if they are engaging in homosexual acts. So for him to come out and say, I am a homosexual, it implies that he has been engaging in those acts, which of course means that he's been cheating on his wife. And this is now the story that is now starting to come out. Apparently there was a young 15-year-old lad that was working on set who used to refer to Philip Schofield as Scofy. And apparently just recently he left the This Morning program in a huff and moved to the Loose Women program. And apparently the word behind the scenes is that he threatened to bring this all out into the open and expose Philip Schofield for being a homosexual and also for having a homosexual affair with him whilst being 30 or 40 years older than him. And this young lad, he was talking about Scofy, as he calls him, since he was 15 years old, according to the Twitter. Now, none of that is confirmed. That is the gossip. But that answers this question of why he suddenly came out when he did, why it's all in the newspapers. They're trying to sort of break the ice so that when this lad comes out with his revelations, it doesn't do that much harm. But I mean, it's just absolutely twisted that they're making him out to be a hero for cheating on his wife. I mean, it's just, you make vows to not to do that. I mean, he's broken his vows. 50 years ago, he would have been kicked out of television for doing something like that and for cheating on his wife. It just shows you how low our standards have become. And how we're really mocking people that actually are brave and courageous by claiming that it's somehow a brave thing to do to be a homosexual. It's not brave.
There's kind of like an implication in all of this that being homosexual is almost like a sacred thing. And so, you know, if you suddenly decide that you're homosexual, then this wonderful sacredness then descends upon you, and you have to be treated with reverence, and everybody has to gush with care for you and express their love for you because you've done this wonderful thing. When in reality, it's, you know, no different to him, as we've just agreed, no different to him admitting that he's had an affair with heterosexual affair. It's no different. If indeed he has actually had an affair, which hasn't been confirmed yet, but that would tend to make sense of the fact that he felt compelled to announce it, because if he hadn't had any affairs, as I said before, his homosexuality would be a purely academic thing, and it needn't necessarily have upset his family life. It needn't necessarily have meant that he had to leave his wife. He could have carried on. If he loves his wife, he could have carried on living with her in a celibate way if he'd wanted to. And that would have been quite a noble thing for him to have done, you know, if he'd realized he was gay and he'd decided that he didn't want to disrupt his family life and cause a lot of anguish to his and embarrassment to his wife. He could have carried on living with her without having any future affairs and in a way that maintained the cohesion of their family.
You know, this is like saying, well, I've been lying to you this whole time. You know, there was another article that came out, but with a woman, I think it was in the Telegraph, and she said that this horrified her because her husband did the same to her after 30 years. And she said how absolutely awful it made her feel that he had been living a lie all these 30 years. And she had thought that he was in love with her, and all the time he had been thinking about other partners that he wanted to have. And this is what Philip Schofield is now putting his wife through. Yes, as you say there, Max, you know, the noble thing to have done would have been to remain celibate or split with his wife and then say that he's discovered that he's homosexual. Not to put her through all of this and then say it's with the strength and the support of his wife and his daughters that he's been able to come to terms with it. I mean, they're the people that he's really hurt through this.
And he's kind of implied that his wife is actually proud of the fact that he's come out as gay, and which is just totally ridiculous. No woman who's been married to a man for 27 years, thinking that she was happily married, and then discovers that he's announces that he's homosexual. No wife is going to be proud of the fact that her husband has, after all this length of time, discovered that he is homosexual. It's just nonsense.
It's the reversal of reversal of standards, the reversal of norms, and again, this, you know, the saying that he's brave and courageous. We will be talking about a properly brave and courageous man later on in the show when we get into our Greatest Britain series with Ernest Shackleton. We've got a couple of other news stories to get into here. A Conservative MP has been punished for attending a conservatism conference. Conservative MP Daniel Kaczynski, who's actually Polish, received a formal warning from the Conservative Party after a social media campaign to oust him for giving a speech at a Conservative conference attended by Viktor Orban and Matteo Salvini. Now, this was actually put on by an organisation that has links with Israel. Both Viktor Orban and Matteo Salvini have both been honoured by Bibi Netanyahu as being specific friends of Israel, and yet these Jewish groups, particularly the British Board of Jewish Deputies and the Jewish Chronicle news site, both lobbied the Conservative Party to have him, to actually have him kicked out of the Conservative Party for this, simply for going to a conservatism conference. And he wrote a good piece in a newspaper saying that he may not agree with the policies of some of the people that were there at the conference, but they had been voted in by their democratically voted in by their population, and they represented views that a lot of the people that support the British Conservative Party also support, and that's why he was there, which I thought was great. This is looking up, things are looking good for the Conservative Party. But Boris has backed down to these complaints, and the Civic Nationalist Press are blaming BuzzFeed and The Guardian, but I think it is really down to the British Board of Jewish Deputies and the Jewish Chronicle, who have a lot more power than people are aware of. And Lord Eric Pickles, he sent a tweet out saying, "Had Daniel attended the conference to confront racists and extremism, he might be justified in attending. Unfortunately, his presence has only brought them comfort. He has let fellow conservatives down." I mean, he's going to a conference with the Prime Minister of Hungary, with the former second-in-command of Italy. I mean, if he was to go there and start calling them racists and extremists, he would be insulting the whole population of Hungary and Italy. And Lord Eric Pickles should be ashamed of himself, claiming that he's let conservatives down by going to this. And also, we mustn't forget that when we were a part of the EU, the Conservative Party were a part of the same grouping as Viktor Orban's Fidesz Party. So there is a link between the Conservative Party and Viktor Orban. Boris Johnson congratulated Viktor Orban when he was voted back in again. So there was no possible reason why he shouldn't have gone. It's just that these special interest groups have complained about this and put pressure on Boris Johnson to censure him for this, basically.
Yeah, this is another example of the drift towards totalitarianism that's taking place in this country, where people are just not allowed to have views that differ from the politically correct woke kind of viewpoint that appears to be prevalent in the media. We're always being told about how wonderful diversity is and how diversity is a strength, but the one thing that all the people that promote diversity don't want is a diversity of opinions being expressed in the media, and they don't want a diversity of opinions being held by people in this country. And effectively, they're trying to stamp out diversity of opinions, and this is an example of that. And so it's deplorable, really, that a Conservative MP can't go to a Conservative conference without being attacked in the way that Daniel Kaczynski has. And I think that it's laudable that he is broad-minded enough to attend conferences of this sort in order to network with other conservatives across Europe.
You can't say that Viktor Orban is an extremist. And he's the Prime Minister of Hungary. He was voted in with a landslide, about 55% or 60%, I think he won at the last time he was voted in. And that was his third term in office, I believe. I mean, how can you call him an extremist? And they're saying that he's an anti-Semite, and yet he's a big fan of Israel. It's just this leftist agenda where everything that is right of centre, I guess you could say, they're now calling extremism and far right, and it's just insulting to the people from these countries. And what it does do is it helps people to wake up, really, that the people that are actually called the far right and the so-called extremists are actually the sensible people that are talking common sense like ourselves. and it drives them to join us, basically. So it's, you know, it may be negative that he's got a bad blot on his record, but all the coverage of it encourages people to support people like Salvini and Viktor Orban in their own countries. Another news story that we got into last week was the It's Okay to Be White stickers scandal in Ipswich. A council has taken down around 60 white supremacist posters plastered around a UK town over the weekend, authorities have said. It's okay to be white and reject white guilt were written on signs across Ipswich, according to images shared on social media. Similar messages have been spotted around different parts of the UK in recent months, including Hull and Perth, according to local media. Signs saying it's okay to be white were also put up in Bristol city centre last week. And of course, the council and the authorities have utterly condemned this. They're calling it white supremacism. They're calling it extremism. And basically what they're saying is it's not okay to be white. You are not allowed to say that it is okay to be white. It is not okay at all, is what they're saying. I mean, they're basically admitting that they hate the indigenous population of Europe by saying that, which is why people have been putting these stickers up. I mean, I have to say that I cannot condone putting stickers up on public property or vandalism of public property or anything like that. I don't know exactly where these stickers were put. I mean, there are public sign places where you can put signs up. Most places have like a board with plastic sheeting in front of it, and you can put your, you know, you can put your local posters up there for people to see and share. How this can be seen to be white supremacism, I don't know. Just to simply say it's okay to be white and reject white guilt. I mean, they're quite innocent things to say.
And when you consider that over recent decades, there have been throughout the media, lots of people who have been declaring that that black is beautiful. You know, black is beautiful is an even more emphatic compliment to skin color than it's okay to be white. You know, all these stickers are saying it's okay to be white. It's not saying white is, it's not even saying white is beautiful, which would then make it the equivalent of black is beautiful. What it's saying is it's okay to be white. There's nothing wrong with being white. And as you say, the reaction that we get basically indicates that the people who object to these stickers are people who don't believe that it's okay to be white. These are people who harbour anti-white hatred, and the public need to just recognise the fact that these people are just full of anti-white hatred, and to tell them where to go. Effectively, it's that there is no reason to suspect that a sticker saying it's okay to be white is racist. It doesn't demean any other race. It doesn't even mention any other race. It's just saying it's okay to be white. And there is a perception with across the country now that being white puts you into a second class category, and that's that there is a need for the pendulum in terms of race relations to swing back a little bit the other way. And so instead of feeling guilty for being white because of alleged injustices done in the past is something which is counterproductive and unhealthy. And that we need to recognize that white people that are alive today didn't participate in any wrongdoing by our ancestors, even insofar as they did do any wrongdoing. We didn't participate in it, so therefore there's no reason why we should feel guilty about it.
We should be feeling proud.
And if we reject guilt, then that's a perfectly healthy thing for us to do.
We should be feeling proud of our achievements in the past. We shouldn't be feeling guilty about them. They've actually formed special anti-racist task forces to deal with this. They've formed a special group to give like half a day's training to counsellors, basically to brainwash them into seeing an innocent sign such as it's okay to be white, to be white supremacist. They've actually given them this training, because obviously it's not an offensive thing to say. They've had to actually get them into a room and point this out and tell them this is white supremacist, to get them to go along with it. And basically, this is the reason why people have put them up. so that the authorities confirm to everybody that what we are saying is true. White people are second-class citizens. It's not okay to be white in 2020 in Britain. You're supposed to not associate yourself with that. And if you do associate yourself with it, you're supposed to beat yourself over the head with it. You're supposed to want to blend yourself out by miscegenating. You're supposed to grovel to any people of colour that you see and apologise to them. I mean, we in America now, they've even got dinners that they have where white, middle-class, liberal women invite around non-whites, where the non-whites then just basically castigate and criticise them, and the white people apologise for slavery and all the rest of it, and whilst cooking them dinner, and they pay them $1,500 for the privilege. That's how bad this has got, this instilling of white guilt in us. Max, do you want to add anything else to that?
No, I think we've said everything that needs to be said. That's we've roundly rejected any suggestions that these things are white supremacist, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah, and there's one final issue that came up last week. Britain First have been engaging in what they call Operation Downs. And what they've been doing is they've been going around the north of England, going to police stations, going to mosques, going to taxi services, and handing out leaflets saying if anybody sees any grooming gang activity in the area, anything that is suspicious like this, please phone the police or phone Britain First. And the goal of it is to raise awareness of grooming gang activity, because the police didn't act upon it. They've admitted they didn't act upon it because of political correctness. So they're trying to raise awareness of it. And they've had a good response from most of the mosques that they've been to and most of the hotels that they've been to. People have taken the leaflets. They've said, yes, we will keep an eye out for it. This is terrible sort of thing. You would imagine Muslims would be, well, yes, of course we want to help you. Because, I mean, that's what they're doing. Basically, Britain First are going to these groups and asking, can you help us? Can you help us to prevent this from happening? That's all they were doing. And one group of Muslims, instead of saying, yes, we'd be happy to help, they have formed an anti-Britain First task force. So instead of actually trying to help with the problem of grooming gangs, they've decided that they would rather be confrontational and aggressive with the group that is actually trying to deal with the problem, which, again, it just highlights, the way that people that are actually speaking up for white interests are now second-class citizens. And that got mainstream coverage, that this Islamic group had formed to have this task force that was going to turn up straight away if Britain First tried to give out these leaflets to try and chase Britain First away from the scene. And it's shocking, really, because you would think that they would acknowledge that this was going on in our community, and yes, thank you for coming round. Yes, we would like to work with you, and yes, we will tell you if we see any of this going on, and we want to stop it as much as you do. I mean, that would be the natural way to act to this, to respond to this, don't you think?
Yeah, this would be this is in effect a form of denial on the part of the Muslim group concerned. A form of denial of something which is now widely accepted as true. It's widely accepted as true that there is a particular problem with Muslims with regard to these grooming gangs. It's been acknowledged not just by right-wing groups, but by mainstream society as well, and even moderate Muslim groups have acknowledged that there is a problem here. And this denial is effectively stating that they would far rather that this problem of grooming gangs continues and persists than to actually do anything about it when taking action against it involves them in having to collaborate with an organization like Britain First. Britain First have not done anything wrong in what they've done here. They've just highlighted the problem and are taking action in the absence of any police action. And I think that more and more in the future, what we're going to find is that as the police who, in fact, this week, a story this week was that the public are progressively losing faith in the police, and less crimes are being reported to the police because people feel that the police aren't interested in enforcing the law. And so more and more in future, there are going to be self-help groups that are going to spring up in order to tackle problems that the police aren't interested in tackling.
Yeah, we've discussed that before as well, haven't we? The idea of private police forces and private security people, because the police are unable to deal with the volume of crime that they have now. I think it's only about 7% of all the crimes actually get solved, and people are now not actually reporting it because they know that nothing's going to be done about it because they're just overwhelmed with all this crime. And of course, it's all centered around the cities, which are multicultural, which has increased the intensity of the violence that's involved in it. None of this would have happened if we didn't have this drive towards diversity, bringing in people that have a much higher propensity towards criminal acts than we do. You only have to look at the figures to see that for their percentage of the population, the amount of crime that the non-whites commit is vastly outweighs the amount of crimes that white people would do, up to 5 times as much, 10 times as much. I mean, there's that famous famous statistic from America. I think it's something like 8% of the population, but 52% of the murders, as far as the black population that they have over there. If it wasn't for the diversity, then the number of police that we had would be enough, and they would still be able to solve the number of crimes that we have. It's like chasing your tail. They're never actually going to be able to deal with it because they're not going to the root of the problem here. Anyway, we've discussed that so many times before. Hopefully, I'm hoping Britain First are moving in a new direction. I don't really want to see them, doing those mosque invasions again and being confrontational. It's much better that they're just sort of advocating for us and trying to get the Muslims to work with them. And you would imagine that the Muslims would want to clear their name. They would want to say, well, no, we're as much against these grooming gangs as you are. Of course, we're happy to work with you, but that's not what they're doing, sadly. And of course, that exposes it. Right. Well, we'll move on to our Greatest Britain series, and we've got a really good one today: Ernest Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Exploration. And you were telling me just before we went on air, Max, that this was pretty much a very British endeavour. Do you want to just get into that a bit more before we start looking at Ernest Shackleton's life?
Yeah, well, it's just that my perception is that during the period, the late 1800s, early 1900s, that a disproportionately great amount of the exploratory expeditions that were being made to the Antarctic were being made by British people, and that had we been assertive when we were undertaking these expeditions, and had we claimed the lands that we had found and that we had explored, then there was the possibility that Britain could have claimed the entirety of Antarctica as our land. Had we done so, because so many of the expeditions were, as I said, Britons, and so little of the exploration of Antarctica initially was being done by people other than British people.
They actually had a lot of problems getting the funding for them as well. I mean, I had to condense this down, otherwise it would have gone on too long, so I actually cut out the bits where Shackleton was trying to get funding. But it just becomes clear that they didn't have the apparatus that we have now that gives out grants to universities and study grants and all of this. He had to get private people, private financiers, to invest in these expeditions. And it was the same for all of them. Scott of the Antarctic is probably the most famous, but Shackleton actually came after. And as we'll see, Shackleton was on one of Scott of the Antarctic's, one of his trips. But we're getting to his early life. The Shackleton family were of English origin. Specifically, they were from Yorkshire. But Ernest Shackleton was born on the 15th of February, 1874, in Kilkea, County Kildare, Ireland. Despite moving from Ireland to London when he was 10 years old, Shackleton took lifelong pride in his Irish roots and frequently declared, I am an Irishman. So he's sort of claimed by the British, he's claimed by the English, and he's also claimed by the Irish because he was born in Ireland. But you can tell that this is a time when people's heritage was still considered to be more important. He may have been born in Ireland, but his family were of English origin. Going back,
no, his father was of English origin, but his mother was a descendant of the Fitzmaurice family, who were a very prominent Irish family from County Kildare.
Ah, right. So he's just on the patrilineal side then. So he had the best of both worlds there. From early childhood, Shackleton was a voracious reader, a pursuit which sparked his passion for adventure. And that's interesting there, because you sometimes think of people that read and they're not really the sporty types, but it can go the other way, and you can read about things that were going on the other side of the world and get this adventurous spirit and want to go out there and do things. So he was physically fit as well as being into these intellectual pursuits. Shackleton's restlessness at school was such that he was allowed to leave at 16 and go to sea as an apprenticeship before the mast on a sailing vessel. During the following 4 years at sea, Shackleton learned his trade, visiting the far corners of the earth and forming acquaintances with a variety of people from many walks of life, learning to be at home with all kinds of men. This would stand him in good stead later on, because he's famous for getting on with his crew, basically, and not having the standard hierarchy that there normally is. By 1898, he was certified as a master mariner, qualifying him to command a British ship anywhere in the world. And I think this was pretty much what most people would do, or this was the choice for a young man, was to go to sea, and you could get on a ship and you could get out and go to New Zealand, go to America, go to Australia, and you know, if you liked one, then you could move there, I guess. Would that be a correct thing to say, Max?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, definitely. I think that it was quite a common thing for young men in those days who had a sense of a yearning for adventure to seek that adventure through exploration and through traveling the high seas. And I think that people would join the merchant navy. Some of them would perhaps have accelerated promotion, but others would join as an able seaman, become a leading seaman, and advance on to becoming a master mariner, and that would be a career that somebody could have, where they would travel the world and have opportunities to perhaps find ways of, or discover things and conduct trade that would make them wealthy and that would make their fortune.
Yeah, we discussed this accelerated going up, basically through purchasing a higher rank. We discussed that in one of the other episodes
we did.
And it's a similar situation here, actually. Later on, we'll see that he gets a friend of his father actually helps him out to get the position that he gets to. In March 1900, he met an army lieutenant, Cedric Longstaff, whose father, Llewellyn W. Longstaff, was the main financial backer of the National Antarctic Expedition, then being organised in London. So you had, like, as I was saying, you had independent financial backers of these expeditions. It wasn't financed by the Ministry for Science or anything like that out of people's taxes. It was all privately done. Shackleton used his acquaintance with the Sun to get an appointment as third officer to the expedition's ship Discovery, and on the 4th of June he was commissioned into the Royal Navy with the rank of sub-lieutenant in the Royal Naval Reserve. So thankfully, you know, he made use of his contacts, basically.
Yes.
The British National Antarctic Expedition, known as the Discovery Expedition after the ship Discovery, was led by Captain Robert Falcon Scott and had objectives that included scientific and geographical discovery. Scott of the Antarctic. Now, I pretty much just know of his name. Do you know more about Scott of the Antarctic at all? Can you recall much about him, Max?
Well, Scott is most famous for being involved in the race to get to the South Pole first, a race that he lost against I think the chap is Dutch, Amundsen, And Amundsen beat Scott by a matter of months in terms of getting to the South Pole. But Captain Robert Scott was a very similar character to Ernest Shackleton in many ways. I think a bit older than Ernest Shackleton, and so therefore more established during the period of Shackleton's life. But again, another chap who came from a military background, who had a yearning for adventure, and who travelled the world in seeking that adventure.
Yeah, we don't know if there was sort of rivalry between the two. Some people say there was rivalry, some people say that there wasn't. According to steward Clarence Hare, Shackleton was the most popular of the officers among the crew, being a good mixer. Although claims that this represented an unofficial rival leadership to Scott's are unsupported. Scott chose Shackleton to accompany himself and another on the expedition's southern journey, a march southwards to achieve the highest possible latitude in the direction of the South Pole. This march was not a serious attempt on the pole, although the attainment of a high latitude was of great importance to Scott, and the inclusion of Shackleton indicated a high degree of personal trust. A record farthest south latitude of 82 degrees 17 inches was reached, beating the previous record established in 1900 by Carsten Borch Grevink. The journey was marred by the poor performance of the dogs, whose food had become tainted and who rapidly fell sick. All 22 dogs died during the march. The three men all suffered at times from snow blindness, frostbite, and ultimately scurvy. On the return journey, Shackleton had, by his own admission, broken down and could no longer carry out his share of the work. Now, I looked into this issue with the dogs, and I mean, it's pretty sick, but one of the things that Scott did to ensure that they actually got to complete their mission was that when one of the dogs died, he fed it to the other dogs. You know, he made use of the carcass. And I'm wondering how the food became tainted. I don't know how new the tinning was, whether they were using dog food in tins. I know that when they first came out of tins, there was problems with poisonings and things like that. And you imagine the equipment that they had 120 years ago in below zero temperatures, snow blindness, frostbite, and eventually scurvy as well. They didn't understand the or they didn't understand what we know today about nutrition. So
yeah, tin cans are soldered together, and I guess that in days of old, before tin cans had a plastic lining, which they do have now, that the solder that would have been used, and the antimony, which is like a flux that's used to help the solder to spread and to bond with the metal, that would have been probably poisonous, and perhaps there was just a bit too much antimony or something of that sort, or perhaps even just too much lead leaching into the meat if the dogs were fed from canned dog food, and that would perhaps have been enough to have affected the dogs.
Yeah, I think there was someone that was trying to go through the Northwest Passage, and he got lost as well, and they couldn't find them. I think they found the ship, and I think they discovered that the reason why they all died was because of that. It was because of the canning. So it could have been a similar issue here with these dogs dying during the march. Scott decided to send Shackleton home on the relief ship Morning, which had arrived in McMurdo Sound in January 1903. Scott wrote, he ought not to risk further hardship in his present state of health. There is conjecture that Scott's motive for removing him was resentment of Shackleton's popularity, and that ill health was used as an excuse to get rid of him. But when he eventually did actually die, they discovered that he had a congenital defect. He actually had a hole in his heart. So even with a hole in his heart, he was still able to make his way pretty much to the South Pole, and, you know, a very hardy man. So this probably was his ill health that actually caused him to go back. I don't like to think that Scott was jealous of his popularity, because Scott's way of commanding was different to Shackleton's anyway. You know, he kept to a strict hierarchy and didn't associate with the men in the same way that Shackleton did.
Yeah.
Well, after that, they had a brief period of convalescence in New Zealand, and Shackleton returned to England, where he became a journalist for a few years and got married, before then trying his hand at politics. So he did a few things while he was back here, and by this time he was making no secret of his ambition in wanting to return to Antarctica at the head of his own expedition, with the aim being the conquest of both the geographical South Pole and the South Magnetic Pole. I didn't realise that they were actually two different things.
Yes, that's right. The actual geographic South Pole is slightly out from the magnetic South Pole. I can't quite remember why it is, but there is a slight difference. It's also worth mentioning that during this period of shore leave, where Shackleton got married, that he also produced three children by his wife in fairly short order, two sons and a daughter, I think. And so he is the sort of person who instinctively believed in securing his immortality through his progeny.
Good man. I hadn't noticed that in there. I just got it down here that he got married during this time. Eventually, he managed to talk enough people into funding his idea for an expedition, and on the 1st of January 1908, the Nimrod set off. Shackleton's original plans had envisaged using the old Discovery base in McMurdo Sound to launch his attempts on the South Pole and the South Magnetic Pole, but before leaving England, he had been pressured to give an undertaking to Scott that he would not base himself in the McMurdo area, which Scott was claiming as his own field of work. Shackleton reluctantly agreed to look for winter quarters at either the Barrier Inlet, which the Discovery had briefly visited in 1902, or King Edward VII Land. To conserve coal, the ship was towed 1,650 miles by the steamer Cunard to the Antarctic ice, and in accordance with Shackleton's promise to Scott, the ship headed for the eastern sector of the Great Ice Barrier. Arriving there on the 21st of January 1908, they found that the Barrier Inlet had expanded to form a large bay in which were hundreds of whales, which led to the immediate christening of the area as the Bay of Whales. I mean, I just find it amazing that this is a ship that's running on coal that they did this in. And their way of doing it was to get the ship towed most of the way so that their vessel that was loaded up with coal had enough to go on it its mission. And of course, obviously, they would have to measure out how much coal they've got and how far it would get them. And if it didn't get them far enough, maybe they would have to turn back, or they would have to wait until the next spring when the ice had melted. All these sort of things you've got to think about. It was noted that the ice conditions were unstable, precluding the establishment of a safe base there. An extended search for an anchorage at King Edward VII Land proved equally fruitless, so Shackleton was forced to break his undertaking to Scott and set sail for McMurdo Sound, a decision which, according to Second Officer Arthur Harbord, was dictated by common sense in view of the difficulties of ice pressure, coal shortage, and the lack of any nearer known base. And when you think about this concern about the lack of coal, you can think, you know, this was a little bit out of order of Scott to say this to him, because he would have wasted all this coal first going to the Bay of Whales, and then after that going to King Edward the Seventh Land, and at both of them he was unable to actually weigh anchor. So that was a bit naughty of Scott to ask him to do that. Because obviously, if he'd asked him to do something, Shackleton would, you know, he would feel that the honourable thing to do would be to agree and say, yes, of course I will do that. And Scott must have known, don't you think? He must have known that it would have caused problems.
I don't know. I wouldn't like to say necessarily one way or the other, but obviously I think that there was perhaps a little bit of friction between the two men in terms of in view of the fact that they were both seeking to have adventures in Antarctica, and in all probability, both of them wanting to be the best and to get to the South Pole first and things like that. So, you know, that's sort of a healthy competition would have been a good thing, and this may have just been a feature of that.
It's a shame, though, isn't it, that he felt that he had to ask that, because I think he would have known that would have, you know, that if he wasn't actually able to find anchorage, that it would have used up all his coal on just, you know, just steaming around trying to find somewhere when he could have used this place that they'd already been to on the previous journey. After considerable weather delays, Shackleton's base was eventually established at Cape Royds, about 24 miles north of Hut Point in McMurdo Sound. The party was in high spirits, despite the difficult conditions. Shackleton's ability to communicate with each man kept the party happy and focused. So he understood how important it was to keep up the morale of the men, and that becomes clearer as we go on. On January 1909, Shackleton and three companions, Wild, Eric Marshall, and Jameson Adams, reached a new furthest south latitude of 88 degrees 23 inches south, a point only 112 miles from the pole. Along the route to the South Pole, the party discovered the Beardmore Glacier, named after Shackleton's patron, and became the first persons to see and travel on the South Polar Plateau. Their return journey to McMurdo Sound was a race against starvation, on half rations for much of the way. At one point, Shackleton gave his one biscuit allotted for the day to the ailing Frank Wild, who wrote in his diary, "All the money that was ever minted would not have bought that biscuit, and the remembrance of that sacrifice will never leave me." They arrived at Hut Point just in time to catch the ship. And, you know, this reminds me of Admiral Bligh with the rations that they had, and they cut down and they cut down and they cut down, and they had just enough to reach Australia. And you can imagine that, having all the food there for a certain amount of time and being starving hungry and knowing that all you can have is one biscuit a day. And, you know, this man is so honourable and loyal to his crew that he gives that biscuit to the member of crew rather than taking it himself.
I mean, one thing is that when they set off on this Nimrod expedition to go to the South Pole, obviously this was the year before Scott actually made his expedition to the South Pole, so that may have been why there was a little bit of competition between Scott and Shackleton. But as when they set off south, that they had ponies or horses to carry their supplies, and that when they ran low on food before they got down to the point of only having a biscuit a day, they killed and ate their ponies.
Wow.
So this is you know, very similar to what had happened before when they had fed the dead dogs to each other. You know, they'd actually needed to kill and eat their own ponies in order to make it back.
Yeah, I've heard of this. There was a plane that crashed, wasn't there, in Peru, and they actually ended up eating one another. I hope that didn't actually happen on any of these Antarctic trips.
I don't think it did, but you know, certainly it was quite common for the people on expeditions, when they really ran low on food, to eat any kind of pack animals they had, but also sometimes they used to eat their dogs as well, and things of that sort. So things did get pretty desperate, and as this story of Shackleton unfolds, we'll realise, you know, just how desperate, you know, they became in the expeditions that they took part in. And but it's a sign of the character of these people that they were prepared to go on these kind of expeditions and risk their lives in order to advance human knowledge, and in order to go to places where no men had gone before.
They actually became very close as well. They all became very close friends. As we'll see right at the end, actually one of his crew members was buried alongside him. They were such good comrades. Well, Shackleton returned to the United Kingdom as a hero, and soon afterwards published his expedition account, Heart of the Antarctic. Emily Shackleton later recorded, "The only comment he made to me about not actually reaching the pole was, 'A live donkey is better than a dead lion, isn't it?' And I said, 'Yes, darling.' as far as I am concerned. So again, he was, you know, very clever with the rations, because, you know, rather than just making it that just that little bit extra and being the first one to get there, he thought, no, I've got to get the crew back. We've got to get back in time, and we've got to all get back alive. In 1910, Shackleton made a series of three recordings describing the expedition using an Edison phonograph. Several mostly intact cases of whiskey and brandy were left behind in 1909, and they were recovered in 2010 for analysis by a distilling company. A revival of the vintage, and since lost, formula for the particular brands found has been offered for sale, with a portion of the proceeds to benefit the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust, which discovered the lost spirits. Now, I wonder why they left those spirits there. Do you think that was for somebody that was following on after them, going on the same trek, do you think?
Well, these expeditions were very much a matter of they were very extensive logistical exercises, where quite often they would have to make one expedition where they would go out towards the South Pole, establishing supply depots. They would just plant a flag, and under the flag they would bury boxes of food and provisions, and then they would go on and plant another flag and bury boxes of food and provisions, and then come back, and then they would go out again with more food, and they would sometimes have to eat some of the food that were in these previous depots that they'd actually made, in order to get further and further and further out into the ice. And so with these kind of logistical exercises, they probably would have taken whiskey and brandy with them, probably not to drink in too great a quantity, because although whiskey and brandy does tend to ward off the feelings of cold, it does actually affect your blood to the point where you then become more susceptible to freezing to death. So I wouldn't imagine that they would have drunk too much whiskey or brandy, but it would have been an interesting distillation of whiskey for the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust to discover. And you can understand why, because of the romance of the story, that they would have wanted to reproduce that particular brand and market it for its nostalgic value.
It would have warmed the cockles of your heart, but possibly not your body, if they'd had too much.
That's
of
right.
It. Well, on Shackleton's return home, public honours were quickly forthcoming. King Edward VII received him on the 10th of July and raised him to a commander of the Royal Victorian Order. In the King's Birthday Honours List in November, he was made a knight, becoming Sir Ernest Shackleton. He was honoured by the Royal Geographical Society, who awarded him a gold medal. A proposal that the medal be smaller than the earlier one awarded to Captain Scott was not acted upon, and there were also a lot of other awards that he was given. Besides the official honours, Shackleton's Antarctic feats were greeted in Britain with great enthusiasm. Proposing a toast to the explorer at a lunch given in Shackleton's honour by the Royal Society's Club, Lord Halsbury, a former Lord Chancellor, said, "When one remembers what he had gone through, one does not believe in the supposed degeneration of the British race. One does not believe that we have lost all sense of admiration for courage and endurance." And that's interesting, because it shows that at the time, that is what was being talked about. The British race was degenerating. There's a book called Are We a Degenerating Race? An Old Sailor's Tale, or something like that. And I think that was written about around about the turn of the century, about this time. And that is exactly what he is suggesting. And he is suggesting that the degeneration has come about through people not being celibate anymore. And that's his actual theory.
There was a lot of thought around about the time of eugenics, and the fact that the less able elements within society were producing large families, whilst the more able members of society were producing smaller numbers of children, and that would have a degenerating effect on us as a race and a nation. And and so that's pretty much what they must have been referring to here, that the fact that we could still produce significant numbers of men that were willing to risk their lives in these really extreme conditions showed that that degeneration hadn't yet set in to a point where it was affecting our ability to function in those ways.
Yeah, interesting that they credit his ability to do this to his biological heritage. Not saying, you know, he's been taught anything, but this is his heritage. It's because he's English, or because he's a part of the British race, that he was able to do this. The heroism was also claimed by Ireland. The Dublin Evening Telegraph's headline read, "South Pole almost reached by an Irishman," while the Dublin Express spoke of the qualities that were his heritage as an Irishman. So, you know, both of those are making reference to his race. Shackleton's fellow explorers also expressed their admiration. Roald Amundsen wrote in a letter to the RGS secretary, John Scott Kelty, that the English nation has by this deed of Shackleton's won a victory that can never be surpassed. And of course, again, this is talking about ethnicity. In the period immediately after his return, Shackleton engaged in a strenuous schedule of public appearances, lectures, and social engagements. He then sought to cash in on his celebrity by making a fortune in the business world. Among the ventures which he hoped to promote was a scheme for selling to collectors postage stamps overprinted King Edward VII land based on Shackleton's appointment as Antarctic postmaster by the New Zealand authorities. Any future resumption by Shackleton of the quest for the South Pole depended on the results of Scott's Terra Nova expedition, which left from Cardiff in July 1910. By early 1912, the world was aware that the pole had been conquered by the Norwegian Roald Amundsen, but the fate of Scott's expedition was not then known. And what
it's interesting here that Roald Amundsen said of Shackleton that the English nation has by this deed of Shackleton's won a victory that can never be surpassed. And then around about a year later, he, as a result of his own determination to seek adventure, did exceed what Shackleton had achieved at that point, and also did it before Scott managed to do it as well, and got to the South Pole first. So that's it shows really that Roald Amundsen, Scott and Shackleton were all cut of the same cloth, really, and it's a very interesting, engaging story. The rivalry between these men,
they're both humble and honourable. He was to say that, and then a year later, he was to become the first one there. I mean, one of the things that Shackleton wasn't that good at was business. In fact, all of his business engagements really didn't turn into anything. He certainly wasn't a businessman, and he wasn't able to fund these missions on his own. Well, I think we'll probably leave it there, Max, and we'll get into the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition next week, which is the really exciting one. Thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget that we do require your donations to keep the website going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet, and I have printed up some new instructions on how people can get hold of Bitcoin and send it to us. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you, and until then, we hope you all have a great week ahead of you.